set the tone of our time. And since there are a few of the elite of the conference gathered together here this morning, we'll be very informal in our time together. And as we get into the principles of the husband and his responsibilities and role, unless you get the wrong idea about it conceptually, I thought I'd offer myself as an example for you so that the concepts and what you can expect will come more into focus for you. It seems that every time, or I'd say just about every time, that I have to make a presentation to couples, husband and wives, or just to husbands, on the husband and wife relationship, or as Brenda and I do a series on just the physical relationship between husband and wife, things between Brenda and me, Brenda and my wife, just come unglued. And I think to myself, self, how in the world are you going to get up in front of people and tell them how it ought to be when it isn't that way with you and your wife? And what I've discovered is that the ideal, the principle, is set down in Scripture that governs our relationship with our mate. But it is not a perfection that you can obtain in 1977, therefore never having any more conflict or difficulties in your relationship. But what it gives us is a way to relate so that we can work through the difficulties and have a process through which we can resolve our differences and conflicts and that kind of thing, so that we can continue to grow and deepen in our relationship with one another. And the thing that I've discovered is that conflict, when resolved biblically, results in a deeper, closer relationship. And what I have seen that many times in a husband and wife relationship that has the appearance of being peaceful and calm, that to step out of that and to begin to argue is a step forward, because that is a hint that communication is about to take place. It doesn't have to, but the conflict does not have to result, but oftentimes there's contract between the two partners that is very peaceful. Little communication takes place between the two of them. There's kind of a coexistence. And then when they begin to see this and begin to relate to each other and share how they really think and feel, conflict is the result. That's not bad, because that's usually step one in a process that will lead you to be able to communicate later on without arguing and that kind of thing.
Would you go so far as to say that in the absence of any conflict, your word is anyway, I know we all know we're talking about the same thing. Is it an unhealthy situation?
No, not necessarily. I couldn't make the statement unless I got to know the people. Because you can relate to people as we do on the surface, and there's never any conflict. It is only as you start going down in the relationship and you get to uncover what's there that conflict begins to result. It doesn't have to. There can be relationships, and I'm sure you have experienced them, that are just kind of natural and very easy. You know, for example, Ken Graham in Fort Worth, who's a dear, dear buddy of mine. We just met and clicked. And he could shoot his mother and it wouldn't bother me. We, have that much of acceptance of one another. And it's just very natural. The only way I can explain it is it's God-given. But my relationship with my wife, Brenda, is not that way. We are very, very different. And to deepen that relationship is required and is requiring a great deal of work and attention. And there are potentially, you know, areas that are explosive and that we have learned to work through. Now, there seems to be a process in relationships that I've noticed in the years of working with people. For example, if I meet Ronnie over here, talk to him at a conference for 30 minutes, I usually discover that my initial impression of people is positive and good. And I think, oh man, Ronnie tells me a few things about himself, and I think he's the greatest thing since, you know, Batman. And boy, you know, Ronnie, come on down to Fort Worth, you know, and, you know, get some training. Well, Ronnie comes down there, and we spend time together now in a closer association. And I begin to notice some things about him that irritate me, and he begins to notice some things about me that irritate me. Well, the more intense our involvement with each other, the more we discover about one another, and then the man who could do no wrong suddenly becomes the man who, well, I don't know if he's ever done anything right. And so there's a period usually that takes place of conflict or adjustment or whatever. And then as you begin to work through these things and have mutual confidence and acceptance in one another, then those things somehow after a period of time don't make a whole lot of difference. But there seems to be a process of initial acceptance, basically because you don't know each other. Then as you get to know each other, there's problems. And then as you work through those things and just begin to relax and to see that you aren't all that much a prize either, and begin to accept, you are accepted, then it really doesn't matter, and you've got the basis of a free, open relationship. But generally, these things don't come naturally. These things are worked on and developed and built. Once in a great while, they'll happen naturally.
You don't mind my asking questions?
Not at all.
Okay. The reason I ask is sometimes you'll find where one mate might be more submissive, you know.
Yes.
And we're told, you read about it, that this can be an unhealthy situation if one makes oneself submissive and doesn't express themselves, we'll say. They really might have some likes or dislikes. But I don't want to bring them up because I know it's going to irritate you. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
This is what I mean sometimes where it would seem an unhealthy situation if someone kept something repressed year after year after year.
Yes, it would be an unhealthy situation.
No.
And what I'm saying is that oftentimes in a marriage relationship, those things are repressed, never brought up, never talked through, and there appears to be a calm, a peaceful, good relationship. When in fact, if you poked into it, you'd find that there wasn't any relationship at all. Okay? Now, by way of background, Brenda and I were married in 1960 when I graduated from Syracuse University, and I took a regular Army commission and went to Germany. And in Germany, I got converted in 1963 and she in 1964. We went together 8 years before we were married, and our relationship was totally upside down. You go through the commandments, we violated them. You read in the scriptures about how that relationship should work. We did everything, it seems, upside down, inside out, and backwards. Well, in 1964, when she was converted at Fort Benning, Georgia, we were living in government housing there, we started to pray together. It wasn't anything fancy. We just kind of sat on the bed Indian style. And she'd pray, you know, 6-7 sentences, and I'd pray 6 or 7 sentences, and that would be the end of it. But I remember in the initial days of praying together that I couldn't help but listen to what she had to say. And as she was praying, I looked at her. I cheated. I had my eyes open. And I saw for the first time in my life, now I'd been going with her 8 years and married to her 4 years, that as I listened to her pray, I realized for the first time in my life that she was a person with real needs, a human being. She wasn't a thing. That came as a giant revelation. because I'd have to confess up to that time I related to her as a thing, somebody to take care of my physical needs, bear my children, clean my house, entertain me, whatever the deal was. Well, it's kind of basically the result of Hugh Hefner's Playboy philosophy. Women in that philosophy are things. But she was a person with needs like mine. What a shock. It was from that point on that God began to deal with us in our relationship to each other. And the next 4 years were very difficult years, but they were the years that God took to take that relationship that was upside down and turn it right side up. And He gave us understanding of the process that He took us through to bring us to where we are today. For that I am very thankful. Very thankful. I am very delighted to be where I am today. I would not want to go back 1 minute and repeat any of the process that has brought me to this point today. I'm grateful for it. It's beyond my wildest expectation. But I don't want the agony that brought it to where it is today. And of course, that agony of correction was the result of the agony of sin that was the base of that whole relationship. But God has in mind for our relationship fantastic things between a husband and wife. And most of us don't experience a tenth of what that relationship should be. But I'm here to tell you, just because you are a Christian, you will not experience in that relationship what you should. Because you are converted, all of your problems are not solved. You have the capacity, because of the resource God has given you, to work it all out. But there's that process that we're being introduced now in the last three chapters of Ephesians to walk, work it out. Work out that which God has worked in you. Paul says in Philippians, working out your own salvation with fear and trembling. So we have learned a lot of bad things in our lifetime about relationships, particularly about relating to women. Now, as we understand what the Scriptures has to say, we have to undo all that we've done, relearn what is at the foundation of that relationship, and do it. And do it while our wives aren't believing us, don't trust us, aren't confident in us, and fighting us tooth and nail all the way through. Does that sound easy? No, it's not easy. Do you have any close relationship that is easy? Probably not many. It's work. And the only way you're going to have a good relationship with your mate is to work. Give it attention and priority. The thing I want to say is this, that Brenda and I still have differences. We are still struggling in areas of our relationship with each other. But there was a time when we didn't talk about our differences. Then there came a time that we'd talk about our differences and we'd argue. And now we've reached a point where we can talk about those differences and we don't argue anymore. We can talk, get new understanding, new insight, and come through it with better acceptance and understanding of the other. And I tell you, that's progress. Will Brenda and I ever not, or come to the point where we'll never have differences? No. You know why? Because there's a phenomena that occurs in that relationship that you may not be aware of. You, in your present set of circumstances, can work out your relationship with your mate to a very satisfactory level. But will you stay at the current level of pressures?
No, of course.
No, you won't. Then you'll get into another set of circumstances, another geographical location, another job, or greater responsibility, and your relationship comes under greater pressure. And then all of a sudden you find those areas that you thought you had solved one time all coming up for rebidding. And you wonder, well, are we going backwards? No, you're not going backwards. It means that you've got to work out things more deeply in each of those areas because you are now under a greater amount of pressure. And what you could get by with at one level, you can no longer get by with at another level. The demands are greater on that relationship. And so you redefine things. You go deeper into those areas between you and your mate. It's a dynamic, moving relationship. It doesn't stand still. It is in continual need of maintenance and repair and developing. If you slack off, it'll destroy itself. Bob?
Is this in the same area, or do these areas change? And the reason I ask that question is, you remember one day you came up and we had coffee, you know, mm-hmm. a couple hours, and I expressed to you an area of the relationship, a friend I had that I thought had been fixed or repaired or was at least at a satisfactory level, and all of a sudden it just kind of crashed and burned. Mm-hmm. And at that time, in talking about that, as a matter of fact, it had already been repaired when we talked. But I got the impression from talking with you then that you were a little surprised that a problem in that area could crop up again after it had been fixed or resolved. Did I get a wrong impression, or have you changed your thinking?
No, I hope you got a wrong impression.
Well, that's the impression that I had.
Yeah. Yeah, no. They'll come up in the same area over and over again. You can work on your physical relationship in this set of circumstances, everything is fine, then you get new pressures, new things in there, and all of a sudden falls to the floor again. And then you try to find out what the deal is, and then you work through that again and work it out. Yes.
When you have a conflict and you pass the stage where you're arguing about it, you can't talk about it. Is the idea, should try to analyze the situation a little deeper and more scripturally than you had before? Is this the whole question of what you mean by deeper relationship?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what happens is that with less pressure, you didn't have to talk about these things because it wasn't pushed. Well, then more pressure comes in, it pushes the thing a little further, puts more stress on it. So in your mind or your wife's mind, more questions will be raised in that same area. And then you'll talk about it, and you won't get anywhere. And then a week or two later, it'll come up again, you'll talk about it again. And another little bit will come out somewhere until after, oh, maybe 1, 2, 4, 10 times talking about it, the whole picture will be painted, and you'll be able to do something about it. But I'd suggest to each one of you men that you make your relationship with your wife and children a daily matter of prayer. I have prayed for years, nearly daily, that God would make me and Brenda experience the oneness that we have. Boy, some days I really regretted that, because, friend, that is a painful process. Because nowhere in any relationship can you see how self-centered you really are than you can in that relationship you have with your wife. Now, I've often said that if you want to see how spiritual a man is, go live in his home for a week, and then you will see what his relationship with God is really like. And if you want an indication of how much light you're walking in with the Lord, according to 1 John chapter 1, just review in your mind how you're doing with your wife and kids. And that'll tell you where you are in your relationship with God. Some of us have got a ways to go. We're not in as much light as we think we're in.
Gordon, wouldn't that necessarily mean, though, one fellow might be carrying more of a burden than another guy, too? You know, I mean, he might have a more difficult wife or mate than somebody else, you know? One gal, very complacent, and everything's lovely, and she's a Christian. And then you might get some gal who is, as we say, hell on wheels, you know, and she's not a Christian, and that's a tremendous burden in comparison to this other. Now, are you going to judge this fellow, this one with case A, with the complacent, lovely Christian wife? You're going to grade him on wifely supervision in comparison to this other one? I mean, the load is far different.
Yes, but the grace available to that person is far different than the other two. And God gives grace to that man to handle that situation. And the problem is him, that guy, availing himself to what's available. Okay, these are just, this is by way of general introduction. Now let's take a look at a couple areas of the husband-wife relationship. One, we'll spend part of our time in Genesis chapter 2, and the other part of our time in Ephesians chapter 5. In Genesis chapter 2, I'd like you to see that God's desire for the husband and wife is to function together as a team. It's God's desire that the husband and wife work together, function together, live together as a team. Now let's look at Genesis 2, verse 18 through 25. Then the Lord God said, "It is not good for the man to be alone. I will make him a helper suitable for him." And out of the ground the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the sky and brought them to the man to see what he would call them. And whatever the man called the living creature, that was its name. And the man gave names to all the cattle and to the birds of the sky and to every beast of the field. But for Adam, there was not found a helper suitable for him. I guess we couldn't say that the dog was man's best friend here, because it didn't work. He needed something else. So the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and he slept. Then he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh at that place. And the Lord God fashioned into a woman the rib which he had taken from the man and brought her to the man. And the man said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man. For this cause a man shall leave his father and his mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed." Now let's see if we can support the team concept from this passage. In verse 18, there are two great truths captured in that very, very simple statement. And we've got to understand this before we be willing to accept the team idea. It is not good for the man to be alone. Now this is a value judgment that God placed on his creation, Adam. He had created Adam prior to this, and apparently he stood off, stroked his chin, and said, it's not good for him to be alone. I'll make him a helper suitable for him. Now what does this tell us about man?
Social creature.
Yes, he's a social creature. And specifically what? Mark?
Incomplete and dependent.
Incomplete. If God is going to make him a helper, what does he need? Help. Profound, isn't it? But if you don't realize that you need help, you'll never accept the helper God has given you. So if we need help, it must be that we are not complete. There is some incompleteness that this helper God has given us provides. Now, what are some of the areas in which we are incomplete? Have you ever tried to have a baby by yourself? That's pretty difficult, isn't it? So physically, we are incomplete in reproduction. I think if we concentrate for a minute on the differences in general categories between husbands and wives, we'll find what some of those areas of incompleteness are. How about in the area of thinking? Do you think the same way your wife thinks? Well, I'll tell you, I don't think the same way my wife thinks. Do men generally think in detail or concept? Yes, generally. This is not always true. In many cases, it's the other way around. But you'll generally notice that in marriages, opposites attract. I think that's really interesting. But anyway, generally, men think in concepts and women think in detail. Illustration. When you made the decision to come up to Glen Eyrie for the week, you say, "Sweetheart, let's do it. We're going to Colorado Springs for a week to attend that conference." As far as you're concerned, the job is done. The only thing you have to do now is get in the car and go. And your mind goes on to something else. And you leave your wife prostrate on the floor. Why is that? Does she think of coming here in the same terms you do? No, not at all. She thinks of all the clothing that's going to be necessary, getting it ready, shutting down the house, taking care of the kids in your absence, and 101 other details that are involved in coming up here. Now, is it better to be a conceptual thinker or a detail thinker?
The person of more value to a business or a world or a faith would be the person with ideas, with a concept. You can always get people carried up. But to originate, to imagine, is a great gift.
Yes. I'm afraid that is where our society puts its premium. But to get a man who can take, or a person who can take a concept and work it out, is also very necessary.
That's true.
Because see, we have here, and usually in a husband-wife relationship, if it weren't for the detailed thinker, usually the conceptual thinker will remain in the clouds, and little will get done practically. It's the detailed thinker that takes that lofty idea and puts feet on it. Bob? Yeah, I would have to say here that one is not better than the other in God's economy of the thing. In the business, I'm sure that there is a premium paid one place. Sure, I'm sure that the high wages go to the imaginative, creative person. But here in God's economy, there is no better way. Both are necessary. What other differences are there? Yeah, I think this ties in. Usually we're ahead and the woman is working now.
A man will generally, this is my, of course, it's all our. A man will generally try to be more logical in his approach and not so emotional. I find women are more emotional in approaching the problem.
Excellent. I think that's one of the basic differences. And that is that generally men are controlled by reason and women by emotion. We are more objective in our evaluation and they more subjective. Now, which is better? Each adds a dimension to the whole. We can be as objective as a robot and slice people into little tiny pieces with our objectivity and do it with about as much feeling as a stone wall. How effective is that? Well, if you're dealing with another stone wall, it'd be all right. But unfortunately, people are not without the emotional side of their character. So our wives add color and warmth and dimension to us that keeps us human. And they add the subjective element that could be very easily missing in ours. But anyway, I think that's enough to illustrate that we are incomplete. And God has given us a helper to complete us. Now, if we need help and God has given us the helper, then what else? What second thing or what second concept is contained in this statement? Who is getting the help? The man. Who is giving it? The woman. Can you make a therefore? What is the implication of that?
Therefore, the man owes something to the woman for the help that he's getting.
Okay. Yes, he does. There's something more basic than that, Joe, in here.
Therefore, responsibility. Responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Okay, if the man is to be helped and the woman to help, therefore we might conclude what? He's the boss. Yeah, I think we can make the implication from that that that's the case. I would say, therefore, that husband and wife team should reflect the husband's character tempered by his wife's. She blends into him. Of course, he blends into her. But it would seem that the predominant characteristic of this team would be that of the husband. Because he is the one that is to be helped by his wife. This does not mean, of course, that he does not help her. But the overall characteristic should be this. I think the implication is that he takes the lead in the thing.
Regard now, what do you do in the case? Now, you know, you've seen this every day. You have a strong, domineering woman.
Mm-hmm.
And you have Mr. Milquetoast.
Mm-hmm.
Now, scripturally, he should lead.
Right.
But talent-wise, this guy doesn't have it to lead, you know?
Wrong.
Well,
let's say
he doesn't use it.
Yes, that I agree with that, Joe.
Wife also is a hurdle.
Mm-hmm.
In his using.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you mean if this guy, if they would wholly submit themselves,
mm-hmm,
God's will.
Mm-hmm.
That God's going to take this milquetoast.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to stand on his feet and say, look, mama, this is the way it's going to be, huh?
Right.
Yeah? Okay.
There is and Joe, this will come together as we get more into it.
Yeah.
There's a classic couple in the scripture that fits that description. The husband is the father of the Jews. Abraham and Sarah were a couple just like you described. Sarah was the flashy gal, and Abraham was a phlegmatic, easygoing fella. How he would lead would be different than another temperament type. But nonetheless, he'd still lead. And we get into that aspect in a few minutes. I'll talk about how, you know, what's involved in leadership. And I think you'll see how he can do it. Okay, let's slip down to verses 24 and 25. For this cause a man shall leave his father and his mother, and they shall cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. I believe there are two foundation stones to this team that God has created when he brought you and your mate together. And the two foundation stones of this team are unity and nakedness. God says, and they shall become one flesh. Now, what's involved in this one flesh experience? This is a deep concept. It's very difficult to explain. I'd like to just touch on it. We don't have time, as we did yesterday, to talk about it because we started a little late today. But I would say that this one flesh relationship involves a whole lot more than just the physical relationship, though the physical relationship symbolizes the union. And the basis of that is 1 Corinthians 6:16. I believe that this one flesh experience that we should have is where the husband and the wife come together and join their spirits, their souls, their bodies into a new entity. There is the husband, yes, there is the wife, but there is also the husband-wife. Do you sense what I'm talking about? And the problem that we face in this unity aspect of the relationship is that when we marry, you've got a husband and you've got a wife. They reach out to one another, and at marriage, they begin to get down inside one another. And as they begin to come together, they experience, well, self-centeredness on both of their parts, and it results in conflict. And because we hate conflict, what we generally do is pull back and decide to live together in two separate relationships under one roof. And we call that marriage. When in fact, all it is a truce between two partners that are living together separately. Now that's not much of a marriage. It's peaceful, there isn't a whole lot of arguing. Looks good from the outside. But it's coexistence under one roof. That's not what God intends us to have in this one flesh relationship. He expects us to come together. I believe that's why almost 2 million couples decided to call it quits in America last year, because they couldn't resolve that. They couldn't come together. You know, it's he, no, it's she, and it's, you know, this kind of thing, rather than working the thing out.
Gordon, I was just thinking you could use the old math formula tree. A squared plus B squared equals C squared. I mean, you have a man's life, woman's life, and then you have a new life with a C squared. Something.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah. A new entity.
Yeah.
Yeah, great. But that coexistence is not one flesh experience. I recall in Fort Benning, Georgia, working with a couple that clearly illustrated this. A couple of couples, as a matter of fact. This couple got married right after they graduated from Cornell University. He took a commission in the military and came down to Fort Benning. He got involved with us in our ministry there and was out with us working with people, growing in the Lord. And his wife, very, very interested in the theater, and was working in the theater in Columbus, Georgia, and involved in a lot of the big theatrical productions. She developed herself in that area, and he in the areas of his interest. And the two of them were good friends, like two little happy kids. And they'd come together late at night, have late, late supper, talk about their experiences in their separate worlds, and go to bed and get up and bounce off into their separate worlds again. And that was life. Well, you protract that 15 or 20 years, and you don't have a whole lot. What will generally happen is that they'll have children, they will unite in their children, and then when their children are gone, they'll get divorced because there's nothing to hold them together. There's no relationship. That's why at the end of 25 years of marriage, that's a critical point. And there are many divorces at that time. That's not a one-flesh experience. There has got to be unity, involvement with one another. Okay, the other foundation stone is that of nakedness. And I just want to mention this. Mr. Hatch touched on it. The man and the women were both naked, and they were not ashamed. They just stand each other in front of each other, stark naked. And neither one of them were embarrassed or ashamed. There was openness. There was total acceptance. And that is the kind of freedom that we should be experiencing in our relationship. Now, I don't know how far to push this, but I've wondered, that's all it is a wonder, if you can't do that before one another with perfect freedom in the physical area, then I wonder if that's an indicator of sin that is being hidden from the other. That you're covering up psychologically, spiritually from the other. And it reads out in your physical relationship with each other. I don't know, but I think it's probably worth thinking about.
Isn't our background, though, you're taught from the time we're little?
Joe, part of it is our background.
That's our culture.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from, you know, you don't go play doctor with little Susie around the corner, you know, master of us.
Mm-hmm.
We grow up with a concept that sex in itself is wrong, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big hang-up for most of us to overcome, you know?
Yeah, it is a big hang-up.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think there's a lot to it. That certainly shouldn't be overlooked. And if that's the case, then just good instruction eventually will dissolve it. But I think there are other things here. I think oftentimes what it shows is that we have a lack of confidence in our relationship with our mate, and so we don't express our true feelings. When we do, our mate becomes defensive, or when she does, we become defensive and threatened, argue, and we cover up. We live covered up from our mate. And when we live covered up from our mate, we wonder why in the world we don't have free physical expression. Well, oftentimes, depending on how your mate is wired together, particularly with women, if you aren't free in the emotional area, don't expect freedom in the physical area, because in her, they're tied intimately together. That's not true across the board. Some people have strong sensual drives that they can lay aside differences and doesn't bother them in the physical department. But I find that the exception rather than the rule. But nonetheless, it exists. So that's it. I believe that God intended us to function together as a team. We need help. God did not make us complete in ourselves, and He gave us our mate to be our helper. We are the ones that set the tone in that relationship. We blend into her, but she blends into us, and that team should have the overriding characteristic of the husband. And unless you can make the basic assumption, based on the sovereignty of God, that the woman to whom you are married is the God-given perfect woman for you, you won't make it. Divorce is not an acceptable solution to any problem you have with your mate. It's out. And the woman you're married to is the right woman, because in the sovereignty of God, He would not let you marry the wrong woman. I do not believe. And you know, I wasn't even a Christian when I got married. Neither was my wife. And you know what? I believe that God, and I can look back and see the control He's had on my life all through those years I was separated from God. And I believe Brenda is God's perfect woman for me, and that she has what I need, and I have what she needs. And this brings me to the last little point here before we move on, and that's this. Generally, we make a large mistake by bemoaning and complaining about the differences that exist between us and our mate. Those differences are not liabilities. Those differences are assets. The problem is we don't know how to use them. See, she is to complete you. And if God gave you another set of you, there wouldn't be a whole lot added. Now, the problem is that we men generally don't know our wives very well. Tell you what, if I were to ask you right now to write down the three greatest strengths and three greatest weaknesses of your wife, some of you may be able to do it in the next hour. If I were to ask your wives to list your three greatest strengths and weaknesses, they could probably do it in 45 seconds. You know why? They know you a whole lot better than you know them. And the crying shame is that God has made you responsible for your wife. How can you help her if you don't know her? You cannot. And see, the focus of our world has become outside of our home. We know the people that work for us and the people for whom we work far better than we know our own mates. That's a crime. And see, our wives have so much wrapped up in us that, boy, they sure are going to know you, because they sink or swim based on how well you turn out. So we've got to know them. And if we'd know them, we'd know what they have that they can add to us and appreciate those differences that exist between us. Okay, then the foundation of that relationship, nakedness and unity. And that's what we should be experiencing. Okay, now how is this supposed to work out? Well, for that, we'll have to turn to Ephesians. Ephesians chapter 5. And hopefully Mr. Hatch will touch on all this. I don't know if he'll get to Ephesians 5 or not. Yeah.
Ephesians 5,
Joe. And, we generally start with verse 22. In Ephesians 5, and it says, "Wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord." Have you ever read verse 21? What's that say? "And be subject to one another in the fear of Christ." You mean to say I'm to be subject to my wife? You bet your life. She to be subject to me? You bet your life. But see, there's a sense where that is not always the case. The whole foundation is to be subject to one another. But in the husband-wife relationship, there's a different twist. There is the idea of wives be subject to their husbands as to the Lord. "For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, he himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and blameless. So husbands ought also to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also does the church, because we are members of his body. For this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is great, but I am speaking with reference to Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let each individual among you also love his own wife, even as himself. And let the wife see to it that she respect her husband." Then verse 4 of chapter 6. "And fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord." Now, there is more in here than we can cover in the next half hour, but we're going to rip through as much as we can of the highlights of what is here. Okay, first you see that there is a comparison drawn between Christ and his relationship to the church and the husband and his relationship to the wife. Now here, Christ corresponds to the husband, the wife corresponds to the church. And it begins by saying that husbands, love your wives, how? As what? As Christ loved the church. Now, if we can follow the comparison, there must be something that we can learn by thinking through how Christ loved the church. Okay, and let's do that for a few minutes. We'll just push it a little bit. How did Christ demonstrate his love for the church? What's one thing that he did to demonstrate his love for the church? He died for it. That's the most obvious thing that he did. Christ died for the church. If that's how he demonstrated his love for the church, then we're to love our wives as he loved the church. What kind of a response would this draw from your wife if she knew that you would lay down your life physically for her right now? Would that have an impact? It would draw a response. The fact that Christ laid down his life for the church, did that draw a response? Yeah, that's why we have all of the therefores in the Bible. It's that foundation. What if you just died to self in your relationship to your mate? What kind of response would that draw? Okay, how else did Christ demonstrate his love for the church? What else did he do for it?
He gave us the word.
He gave us the word. In other words, he instructed the church. He gave it direction. Does that tell us anything that we ought to be doing for our wives? If we love her, we'll be doing the same thing for her. Because notice in verse 25 and 26 that the sanctification of the church is all wrapped up in Christ. The sanctification of our wives is all wrapped up in us. What else did Christ do for the church?
Makes us secure.
He provides security for the church. We are secure in him. He provides security for our wives. That demonstrates our love for her. What else did he do for it? Do you pray for it? You bet. We demonstrate our love for our wives by praying for her. And you can go on and make a list, as I have done, of some 25 to 30 things that Christ did to demonstrate his love for the church. And you can spend 25 weeks taking one thing a week and implementing that one thing in your relationship with your mate. I'll bet you by the end of the 25 weeks or the end of the first 3 weeks, your relationship will be so revitalized you won't be able to stand it. Now, so you can flip the coin around and say, yes, I am to love my wife as Christ loved the church, but see, your wife is also to be subject to you how? As the church was subject to Christ. And then you can think through together on how the church was subject to Christ. And that'll give you a good idea of how she is to relate to you. Okay?
Have you done that study, Gordon?
Uh-huh.
How many things did you
get? Oh, I can't remember on that. 15, so somewhere in there.
In
yeah. Okay, now, we are to love our wives. Now, what does it mean when it says, husbands, love your wives? Well, we just discovered a practical approach to the thing by following through the comparison that we have. Where else can we look to see how we should love our wives? I think if we could define love, we'd know what we'd be doing. We have a pretty faulty concept of what love is. You know, I think many of us have the idea that love is an emotion and that love is something that you raise up from deep within you and you just kind of, you know, ooze this love for people. It's kind of a gushy thing. Now, is that the love with which we are commanded to love our wives?
It's a broader knowledge of love than that, intellectually also.
You bet your life, Joe. When the word love is used in the Bible, it is the translation of two Greek words, and you got to know what Greek word you're dealing with when you see the word love. Because when you just see love, it could represent one of two Greek words. One of the words is agape, which is a God-given love. Here you are. Here God is. And when he says, husbands, love your wives, he is saying, love them with this agape love, this love that originates with me. And he says also, the wives are supposed to love their husbands with this God-given love. See, then there's another Greek word for love, and that's phileo or phileo, something like that. And this is the love that has to do with friendship. It is an emotional love that is not, does not have its root in God. It has its root in man. It's emotional. And Jesus had this kind of love toward the disciple whom Jesus loved. Remember in the Gospel of John? He had this warmth, this special kind of feeling toward Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. It's kind of, it's a friendship, companion kind of thing. Well, in our relationship with our mates, we should have the emotion, feeling, and just plain old good passion. But none of these things are involved in the command, husbands, love your wives. It is this kind of love that we're commanded to love with. 1 Corinthians 13 gives us the description of this kind of love. Now, in the Bible study session that I did, we spent a little bit of time talking about it. In 1 Corinthians 13, verses 4 through 7, we have the description of this love. And what I did was to go through that thing and put all of the positive descriptive qualities of love in one pile, and all of the negative descriptive qualities, what love is not, in another, and try to see if there was a common denominator to come up with a definition of what this agape love is. Well, first thing it says is that love is what?
Patient.
Love is patient. Okay, what else is it?
Kind.
Love is kind. What else?
Versus the negative,
doesn't it? Not jealous, does not brag, is not arrogant, does not seek its own, and it goes on. There are some 15 or 16 descriptive qualities there. Now then I took that paper and held it out to see if I could find something that went through them that would tie it all together. I began to think, well, if a person is described as patient, where is the focus of that person? Where's the focus of a patient person? No, it's outside himself.
Toward others.
Toward others. His focus is the other person. Okay, if I'm self-centered, am I going to be patient? No, I'm going to be extremely impatient because you're not hitting me, boy, where I want to be hit. Okay, where's the focus of a kind person? Out or in? Out. It's others. Where's the focus of a jealous person?
Self.
Where's the focus of a braggart?
Self.
Where's the focus of an arrogant person? Begin to get the picture? There is a common denominator in all those descriptive qualities. So see, based on that, I come up with a definition of love. How would you define love?
It's unconditional.
Okay, it's unconditional. Does it depend on the other person? It does not. The best the world has to offer is this. I'll love you if you love me. If you stop loving me, I'll stop loving you. See, we're commanded to love regardless of what the other person does. How would we define it? If love is focusing on, there's a definition, focusing on other people. You know how I defined it from this? I define love as unselfish concern. Love is selflessness in relationships.
Should there be a dimension of expression in there someplace?
That's what all of those descriptive qualities are. Yeah, but I'm trying to wrap up each of these little pieces into something other than the word love. And the closest thing I can come to it is unselfish concern. Now, is that emotional or not? Being unselfishly concerned.
I think it's part of it, or it can be part of it, but not necessarily.
Okay, yes. When you say love is unselfish concern, that's not emotional. If I am selfless in my relationship to a person, I can be... That's intellectual. I can decide to love you or not. I can decide whether or not I am going to be unselfishly concerned in my relationship with you or not. That is a decision. It requires an act of the will. I decide to love you or not. How can I check that out? Because it is a command of God to love. And if it's a command to love, therefore the act must be an act of the will. I decide to love you or I decide not to. And if I love you, how it will work out is that I will be patient, I will be kind, I will be all of those things that are described in that pile in 1 Corinthians 13. Now, we are commanded to love our wives. Is that emotional or unemotional? That's unemotional. You can do it. You can learn to do it.
Go ahead. Let me add when you were growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Did you ever love someone, but perhaps knew you shouldn't love them?
Love them, knew I shouldn't.
Yeah. I mean, that was a personal thing, though. That was a decision that you might love them and you didn't want to. So we'll say someone that... hurt you, some gal, you know, number one in high school or something that passed you by or something. You know what I mean?
Yes.
We've all had it happen. And I don't see how that ties in exactly. I mean,
okay, I'll show you how it ties in, Joe. This love, this love here is not emotional. It is characterized by very specific qualities that you either decide to do or not to do. But from within, the seat of our emotion, feeling, goes back and forth. Two different sources. We're talking about two different things.
Intellectual and emotional.
Emotional, right. And see, this love we decide to do, but the source of it is not me. The source of it is God. For example, I came to the conclusion some years ago that I really didn't love a particular set of people. And when I realized it, I just went to the Lord in prayer and said, God, I don't love these people. Let me experience your love in me for them. And turn to the Lord. And then walked out, trusting that God would work that in me, and started treating them kindly with patience and that kind of thing. God meant to them. A little footnote. See this little illustration here? Let's suppose you stop loving your wife for a while. Will conflict result?
Sure.
No, look at the illustration.
Well, I'm just talking from experience.
Yeah. Just look at that illustration now. Will conflict result in that illustration?
Well, you've still got a triangle.
That's it?
Yeah.
That's it?
Yeah.
You still have got a triangle. No conflict will result. Why? Because your mate is still loving you. You can be ranting and raving, but what is she doing?
Well, you didn't say that. She was still loving. You said if you stop loving your wife, I mean, would you still?
What if you stop loving your wife, you see what she's doing. She's still loving you, isn't she?
Yeah.
And you're ranting and raving and orbiting off the ceiling and all that other stuff, and she's still there. Honey, where's the conflict? There isn't any. It's only when you both stop loving one another that you have conflict. It takes two to tango. It takes two to have a conflict. Okay? That's the first point I want to make. Now, the second point has to do with the roles. And I think this will be the most helpful area, and we'll have to cover it speedily. Based in Ephesians 5, what is the role of the husband? What is he? He is the what?
The head.
The head. That's right. Thank you, Joe. He's the head. And what is the wife? She is to submit, or she, from Genesis 2, is the helper. Now, which role is the more important in God's eyes? Pardon me?
Man would be most important.
Wrong.
According to what you've been saying, they're both equal.
Right on, Joe. Marriage is not a 50-50 proposition. Marriage is the man functioning 100% in his role as head and the wife functioning 100% in her role as helper. And in God's eyes, remember the end of Galatians where Mr. Hatch quoted, in Christ there is neither what? Male nor female. It cuts no ice that you're a man and your wife's a woman. Doesn't give you any special place in the kingdom of heaven. They're all viewed the same. And in the husband-wife relationship, you will be held accountable for your performance in your role. She will be held accountable for her performance in her role. Both are absolutely necessary in that family relationship. One is not more important than the other. Okay? Now, as head, of course, we're the leader. And what is the most important aspect of leadership? What's the most difficult part of leadership?
Example?
Example? No, decisions. That's it. And that's the thing I want to develop with you. I think, and this is getting to what you said earlier, Joe, what makes the leader, the biggest part of being a leader is decision making. Who makes the decisions determines who's the leader. Because the decision maker is the one who shoulders responsibility. And I would say that is one of the biggest areas of our responsibility, decision making. Now let's talk about decision making, because the principles that apply there will apply in every aspect of our relationship to our mate. I've learned this the hard way. Many of us will come bounding out and say, "Sweetheart, this is what we're going to do." And she says, "Well, did you think about this, and what about this, and what about that?" And you say, "No, I really didn't. But by golly, I'm the head of this thing, and here she is challenging me." And then standoff. She drives you in the corner, and there's only one way I know of to come out of a corner, and that's fighting. Bam. Because she has shot you and your idea right to the floor. Now, we really didn't mean to come out and say it that way, but since we did, we got committed to it and followed through with the thing. You know, what we could do is this. We could come out and say, "Sweetheart, what do you think of this idea?" She says, "Well, how about this, this, and this?" Bad idea. Boom. Now, what's the difference between that and the first way of doing things? You're not in the corner. Yeah, you've got an abstract idea that is being evaluated. And if it comes out a bad idea, so what? The idea goes down. I've had bad ideas before, and I'm going to have more bad ideas. But she is given an opportunity to bring her resource to bear in that idea. And you can gain a great deal by listening to what she has to say about an idea that you may have. And then you make adjustments, or you totally throw that thing out and come up with a new plan. Okay? And this, I think, is what we need to do. We need to present an idea, or she presents an idea. You discuss it, and then who makes the decision? Men, we do. That's what we are called to do as leaders, make the decision. Oftentimes, it's just kind of a mutual thing that works out. Bam, we decide to do it. But if push comes to shove, we have got to make a decision. And you know what we do a lot? We know that our wives see things differently than we do. So we kind of pre-guess what it is that she is going to, well, argue about for the sake of an argument, even though we don't think it's right, we'll do it anyway. You know, after all, you can't win fighting City Hall. And so we make her the standard of our decision making. Now, there's a couple of characters in the Bible that did the same thing. Adam is one. Eve was deceived and ate that fruit. Sin didn't come into the world through Eve. It came into the world through Adam. Why? Adam wasn't deceived. He went into it with his eyes open, but he listened to his wife. How do I know? Genesis 3:17, where the curse on man is pronounced, it starts off this way. And unto Adam he said, because thou hast hearkened unto the voice of thy wife. And then the curse is pronounced. Why? Because you listened to your wife when you shouldn't have, you idiot. Then Abraham and Sarah. God gave them a promise, but God, you know, he's just a little slow in bringing that thing out about. And so what does Sarah come up with? Well, she has a great idea. Abraham, why don't you go take Hagar, my handmaid? And then Hagar conceived and bore a son. What did Sarah say about that? Why, she went straight through the tent. A loose translation would be, Abraham, you idiot. Why did you do what I told you to do? But Sarah, you said... See, then Abraham went out because Sarah told him another thing. Sarah told Abraham, Abraham, you get rid of Hagar and Ishmael. And boy, that broke old Abraham's heart. But he went out, and what did God tell him to do? He said, Abraham, she's right. Get rid of them. Now there's a lesson in there, isn't there? And the lesson is this. Our wife is a valuable resource in the decision-making process. Hear her out. You then take that information and you, before God, decide the will of God for your family. And then announce the decision. And friend, when you make that decision, you stick with it. You know what's going to happen? Your wife is going to argue and fight and cry and do all sorts of things to try to get you to change. And you know what? She's fighting a battle that she does not want to win. Because if she can change your mind, her security is going to be severely shaken. Our wives are like children in that regard. When children have bounds set, and every time they violate the bounds, discover them again, they become secure. When your wife sees that she can easily twist you and get you to do whatever she wants you to do, she begins to reason, I wonder how many other people are doing the very same thing with him. What a wishy-washy kind of a guy. And her security is shot. She loses respect for you. And you say, well, I'm just doing that to make her happy. It's See, you're not living in response to God. You're living in response to an easy, conflict-free relationship. And you're going to lose. You're going to lose badly. Well, I can go on and give you a lot of other information. Take finances, for example, in the family. Who is making the decisions in regard to finances in your household? Who should be? You should be. I should be. You should decide where the money is going to go. Okay? What about a wife who is writing the monthly checks? Good or bad? Fine. Doesn't make any difference. Can your wife be your helper as your secretary?
Yeah.
You bet she can. And take a big load off you. But the key issue is, who is deciding where that money is going? Who has the burden of figuring out what bills are not going to be paid this month because there isn't enough money? Who goes to who and asks for money to do things? That will determine who is shouldering the responsibility and making the decisions in that area. What about the raising of the children? Who is responsible for that? According to Ephesians 6:4, the instruction is dumped flat on us. Fathers. Okay, how do you handle that one? Well, you and your mate get together and decide how you are going to train your children. And then once you've decided on the rules, then she implements in your absence the things that you have agreed upon together. In my household, my children are disciplined with a wooden spoon in the rear end for disrespect, disobedience, and lying. And any time they cross over that, if we're half awake, discipline is administered. And you know what? We've got four very nice kids. Oh, I've got my problems with them. But we're not in any bad shape with them. Got good communication with them, and they know the limits. Well, in my absence, my wife ministers discipline when necessary. But when I come home, I again take over the discipline of the kids. Boy, and I see this over and over again. Men coming home from work, sitting in the house, me visiting with them, and the kids just acting like a Chinese fire drill. And who is taking care of the kids? The wife, screaming and hollering and feeling the burden for them. When you're home, they're yours. If you need to, you can tell me to just sit still for a minute. I got a problem to take care of. And take 15 minutes out and go through the whole process of training your children. Because your priority should be those kids, not me or whoever your visitor is. It should be those children. So it's your responsibility. You better decide and shoulder it. And you know what? If you step in and become the head as you should be, your wife will reverence you, she will respect you, she will follow you. After a while, she won't trust you at first, and she'll fight and argue and kick, but she wants to lose. And then she can become free to be the comforter and be what God intended her to be in her role. But what has happened in most American families is that the husband has stepped out because he doesn't want the responsibility. He reasons, well, I got enough responsibility in my work, and I come home, I can leave Jesus out in the front yard in the car, and I can become self-centered again. I deserve it. And what happens is that the wife steps into the power vacuum, and you've got two people in the family out of their roles. You know what that does to children? That produces maladjusted children. And when you have both the husband and the wife out of the role, it results in homosexuality in kids, because they cannot relate to the proper father image or the proper mother image. and you have just inherited the whirlwind. This is serious stuff. And all the answers are there in the scriptures. You don't need, you know, giant books and psychology and all the rest of it. It's all right there. Okay? Well, there's a lot more we could talk about, but that's just enough to get you going. Okay? Let's quit. Quit.
Thank
you. Yep. Jonathan, I take it chapter and verse, but where sin abounds, grace abounds more. You know, in Romans, The idea is that you are never confronted with any problem or difficulty or whatever where God does not provide you the grace to meet that specific situation. He does every time. When you're having all sorts of problems, your wife dies, for example, God provides grace for you to get through that set of circumstances. I come bopping in and look at that thing and I say, oh my goodness, how in the world can I handle that? Well, the reason is you can't handle it because there's no grace for you to handle it because it's not your set of circumstances. But the person who's in it can handle it a whole lot better than the person who's observing it from the sideline. Because God is meeting you because it's your...
That's assuming the person is a Christian, is a child of God.
Oh, Joe, that's the basic assumption of all of this. And you see now from this that unless you have a growing, vital relationship with God, none of this is going to work.
That's right.
Okay, I guess we better go to lunch.